Okay, I'm Jeff Reckenbach. We're here today with Debbie Hayes at her home in Buffalo, or a
Grand
suburb of
Island,
Buffalo,
New York.
Grand Island. Oh, I've been to Grand Island. And also with us today is Debbie Goldman and Hannah Goldman from Washington, D.C. And we're going to conduct an interview with Debbie Hayes about her career with the Communications Workers of America. Debbie, welcome. Thanks for doing this with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So let's before we get into your CWA career, let's talk a little bit about your growing up. Tell us a little bit about well, first off, when you were born and where and a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born in Buffalo in 1957. My parents were Paul and Joan Bonney, and I grew up in the Riverside section of Buffalo. I'm the oldest of six children. My mother had five of us. The first 6 years she was married.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and then I have a sister who is 12 years younger than I. So there were three boys and three girls. We grew up on what folks called the industrial curve in Buffalo. So in one part the neighborhood we lived, there were a lot of small family homes. And then you would cross a major road and there was the interestingly enough, the Western Electric plant was right on the corner of my street. And then J.H. Williams and a huge Chevrolet complex. So grew up in a working class neighborhood.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, my parents are Catholic, and so we went to a Catholic grammar school, St. Elizabeth's in Buffalo. I went there for 9 years, and then I went to Holy Angels Academy for high school, and then DeYuval College for my degree in nursing. So I had a very, very happy childhood. We were poor, but we really didn't know it at the time because my parents worked very hard
What
to
kind of
make
jobs did
sure.
they do?
My mother, before she was married to my dad, was an executive secretary for a furniture company in Buffalo. And my father was a skilled tradesman. He was a pattern maker. And he worked at American Standard before it closed, and then worked in a small machine shop, and then went to the Chevrolet foundry before that closed. And then after my sister was born, when I was about 12, my mother went to work in the Chevrolet Forge cafeteria. So she worked for Greyhound Food Services and did that type of work. And that actually was my first. I was 16 years old and it was 5 o'clock one morning. I was happily sleeping away in my bed and my mother tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "I think we have a job for you," and whisked me away to the foundry cafeteria, and at 16 years old, that was my first union job. I worked
Wow.
for the Greyhound Food Company. I was a member of the UAW, and I worked cleaning tables and picking up garbage in this massive factory cafeteria.
Wow. So, and I presume your father was also a UAW member at that point as well?
All three of us were
Yeah.
UAW members
Yeah.
at one point, yes.
And is that Chevy plant is gone now, right? If I remember.
It is. They closed it down. The big motor plant on River Road in Buffalo is still there. But the complex as we knew it in its heyday is gone.
So you talked a little bit about your education. Tell us more about college and your career pursuits from there.
So high school
Back,
was tough.
can I back up for
Of
1 minute?
course.
Did you give us the year of your birth?
She did, 1957.
1957, yes,
I
March 29th,
apologize.
1957, no problem.
And I wanted to also ask about your Catholic upbringing and how, if at all, that might have shaped your values. And then I'll be quiet.
No, it we it, and it's interesting because I was just talking about this with someone. We were taught several lessons from a very early age, and our Catholic values were a part of that. My dad always taught me, number one, nothing's ever going to be handed to you. You're going to work hard for anything you get, so be prepared for that. He taught me to love my sisters no matter what, because when no one else is there for you, your sisters will be. He taught us to respect the elderly, and we mowed lawns and carried garbage and recycled their newspapers and were very hands-on in terms of helping elderly family and neighbors. And he taught us just a lot about love. And what we didn't have in money, he taught us that we had in terms of our family, and we were rich in our siblings. So in terms of my Catholic faith, we had went to mass every morning from 8 to 8:30 before our classes started. And my parents often took us on Saturdays, and then we had our Sunday obligation. So we spent a great deal of time in church and part of the Catholic community in Buffalo, especially in those early years. And some of the same lessons my father taught me were the lessons that I learned in school, which I think the things that stuck with me the most were just taking care of the less advantaged. If there was someone who didn't have something that I did, I would share it, and that included my lunch. I never liked it when people made fun of other kids for what they had or didn't have. I was always kind of a champion for the, or stood up for the underserved and underprivileged. And that was something I learned in school and just really followed me through the rest of my life.
And the community you grew up in, was it an ethnic community? And what was the ethnic background of your parents?
It was an ethnic community. Buffalo is divided into a series of ethnic communities. So the Irish settled in South Buffalo and the Italians settled on the west side and the Polish on the east side. And I grew up in a Hungarian parish. Saint Elizabeth is the patron saint of Hungary, and my father's parents were born in Hungary. My mother's parents, I think, were second generation Americans, and my grandfather was German and my grandmother was German and Irish.
And where did the
So,
black slip live in Buffalo?
the Black community lived also on the east side, inner city and east side. The demographics of the city have completely changed now. And while there are still some of the traditions in neighborhoods, like there was a Polish neighborhood in what is now Cheektowaga, and you see street signs that are Polish names, and the black members of the community now live largely on the east side of Buffalo, north of Main Street in Buffalo, into Cheektowaga, and then in the inner city. Buffalo has now is a city of immigrants, and even before the more recent discussions on immigration, we had several centers that welcomed immigrants and help them get themselves and their families established in the city. And so we have a massive immigration, I'm sorry, immigrant population in the west, on the west side of Buffalo.
Okay, I
So
was
it's
just trying to establish you grew up basically in a white working class environment.
white working class environment, yes. My father's best friend at American Standard was a black man named Kenny Olden. And, I learned from a very young age that you just don't judge people by the color of their skin. And, my father taught us that very early on, that you have to know the person and judge them by who they are and not the color of their skin. So we very often would go to they call it the fruit belt, because all of the streets are mulberry and peach and streets like that, to visit Mr. Olden. So, although I grew up in a white working class neighborhood, it was also not uncommon for us to visit the neighborhood where the black folks lived.
You know, it's interesting. So we've been doing these for a couple of months now, and a common theme about of the people we've talked to is this sort of empathy for the underdog or the underserved early on in their lives, and that sort of manifests themselves at some point later on into a career in the labor movement. And so in your case, obviously that was a situation as well. So you've stayed in Buffalo basically all your life. Are your siblings all still in the Buffalo area?
I have one sister that now lives in North Carolina. She followed her daughters there after college so she could be close to her grandchildren. And I have a brother who, after he was married, moved to California. And so he's been on the West Coast his whole life. My mom passed away in 2021, when she was 88 years old, and my dad is going to be 94 in June, and he is still alive and lives in the home I grew up in.
Wow, you're swimming in a pretty good gene pool there.
I am.
Yeah, good for you. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about college and your career choice. At some point decided you were going to go into the healthcare profession. How did that all evolve?
I knew that I wanted to be, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a doctor or a nurse. I loved baby and I loved obstetrics, and I thought that might be a career for me. But toward my junior year in high school, I wasn't sure if I had the grades that would get me into a medical school. And so I had a wonderful guidance counselor in high school, and we talked about nursing as a profession and the fact that Yuval College was right in our backyard, and they had an excellent nursing program. So high school was that were tough years for me because I was always the kid that was born on the wrong side of the tracks. And college was just the opposite. College was just wonderful, and I felt like they were years where I could really find myself, and I learned, and I loved what I was learning, and I had great friends. So four very, very good years. When I was 20, right after my sophomore year, I moved into my own apartment. So I have been independent since I was 20 years old. And about the same time, I left my job at the Chevrolet Foundry cafeteria and went to work at a nursing home, which was the first job I had in the healthcare industry. I worked there as a certified nursing assistant, and it was excellent experience for me to start to get my feet wet in the profession. So I worked at the nursing home as a CNA, and after 3 years of college, I could take my LPN exam and work as an LPN, which I did for several months at the nursing home, and then went to work at Buffalo General Hospital.
And Buffalo General is where your union inspirations began to generate. Do I have that correct?
Yes, when I graduated from college in 1979, I became a registered nurse and changed units and started working with a new group of nurses. And it didn't take very long for me, number one, to experience reality shock. So the difference of what you learn in school and then what it's like when you're actually in the workplace was extremely different. And then, I listened to my coworkers, especially folks who had been there for a while, about just how difficult the work conditions were, and how they felt like they were undervalued, short-staffed, and that the wages and benefits that folks were making at the time were completely wrong for the educational levels that people had and for the type of work that we did every day. So that is where it started.
Yeah. And so out of that, you've got this robust UAW background. How did you happen to think about the communications workers as the the path to organizing within the hospital?
So we originally wanted to, and this is a whole long side story. I'm not sure that
That's what we're
you.
here for, long side stories. Go for it.
Okay. So when I took my nursing boards in 2000, I'm sorry, in 1979, they were 2 8-hour days of answering questions. And, you know, back then it cost $150 to take them. And you go to a convention center and you sit in a massive room of people and you just answer these questions for 16 hours. And the year that I took my boards, the commissioner of the Board of Regents in New York State decided that he was going to invalidate the boards because he had 28 anonymous letters that there was cheating going on. And we went to the New York State Nurses Association, NYSNA, for help. And they basically said, look, pay your registration fee and just sit and take the boards again. And that was completely unacceptable to graduate nurses in New York. So we formed these graduate nurse groups all across New York State. And we decided to sue the state of New York. And part of what we did is collect signatures and petition on a petition in support of what we were doing. And the commissioner came to Buffalo to do a press conference. So during the press conference, I had my uniform and my cap on, and I presented him with these petitions. And an organizer from 1199 from SEIU was there. And he tapped me on the shoulder afterwards and said, if you can do this with graduate nurses across New York State, imagine what you could do in a hospital where you have problems. And he said, you know, have you thought about unionizing? And at that point, we had not. And he gave me his card and he said, if you're ever interested, you should call me, which is exactly what I did. But there was another union in Buffalo that SEIU was a part of. They had formed a council to organize healthcare workers. It was SEIU, the hotel workers, and the laundry workers. And when we did call, this man's name was Bruce Popper. When we did call Bruce and told him we were interested in organizing and had a couple meetings with him, the president of this council, who also had ties to the mafia, brought him in and sat him down and said, this is my territory, and so you need to stay out of here. And his sidekick opened his suit coat, and you could see he had a gun on the side of his belt, and Bruce had to stay out of Buffalo. And this council wanted us to organize with them. And, you know, we had absolutely no desire to be a part of their organization. And so we felt kind of lost. We didn't want to go to NYSNA because they told us, pay your registration fee and take the boards. And we didn't want to go with this mafia-dominated hospital council, and SEIU wasn't there. So there was an article in the paper about our plight, and a woman named Ronnie Waltrich from the VNA called me and said, listen, my husband is a manager at New York Telephone, and his union, he told me his union, the union that represents the workers there, is incredible. and told us to organize with CWA, which they did, and they had just gotten their first contract, and they said, you really need, she told me, you really need to call CWA and meet with them. And so that's what we did. We called Local 1122, and Don Hope was the president there. But there were two people in particular on the board at that time, Chris Kretsch and Jerry Hayes. And they just, the whole local, but especially Chris and Jerry, took us under their wing and taught us everything we needed to know about organizing a union. And I tell everybody, industry doesn't matter. Like Morty and I had this conversation once when he was in Buffalo. We were getting ready to do a press conference, and he said to me, Debbie, I don't know anything about healthcare. And I said, Morty, I don't know anything about unions. So you can learn healthcare from me, and I'll learn about unions from you, and we'll be good. And that's exactly the way it went. I learned everything I know about organizing, representing my representing ourselves from the telephone workers at 1122 and other colleagues in the district.
What an incredible moment of serendipity there, huh? I mean, just that, somebody to call out of the blue and say, hey, this is the union you should talk to.
Yeah, it
And
really
coming
was.
a recommendation coming from a manager that worked with that
Right.
union was just
Yeah.
makes it all the more interesting. So that's incredible. What a
It
story.
is incredible. And just
Yeah.
to round this off, I will tell you that while we were organizing with CWA, my car got vandalized three times. Once at work, once in front of my apartment, and once when I was at a union meeting. And it never dawned on me that someone was trying to scare me or do me harm until several years later, an FBI agent showed up at our office, and he had his big gold badge, and he knew everything that had happened to me and about the vandalizing, and they knew who did it and why they did it, because they were trying to scare us into joining this hospital and nursing home council.
Wow.
And I was so just naive and world, I guess, inexperienced at the time that it never dawned on me that that's what was happening.
Wow. Frightening in
What,
hindsight, but
yes.
yeah.
What is VNA?
The Visiting Nurses Association. It's now of Western New York. It has grown from several hundred members to almost 600 members in the eight counties of Western New York.
Okay, so let's take a few minutes and talk a little more about the organizing campaign at Buffalo General and the role that the folks at 1122 played. Jerry and Chris are great friends of mine. They're wonderful people, so I'd like to hear more about
They
all of
are.
that. Yeah.
Jerry was, and so was Chris, but it was interesting to me that back in the early 80s, Jerry was really a feminist, and he was Chris's greatest supporter and really treated us with the kind of respect that and believed in us in a way that we never received at work. And the way they taught us to organize was very similar to the CWA model. So map the workplace, identify all the areas where nurses work, get contacts from all of those areas on all shifts, build a committee, and then we'll go from there. And the interesting thing with Chris and Jerry is I don't know if they showed up at one meeting that we did. They would meet with us, teach us what we needed to know, help us set the agenda. Any materials we needed, we could get from the office. But then the meetings we did on our own. So they taught us to be very independent, to be sure about what we were doing and why we were doing it. I still am afraid of public speaking, but I would get up in front of, my coworkers and groups of nurses and talk about my experience at the UAW and why union made sense at Buffalo General. And so it took us a long time. It took us well over a year to organize the nurses there.
And what year is
But
this?
I think we organized starting in either late 80 or 81 and had our certification election in June of 82. And that any of these dates, if you want more accurate dates, I definitely can do more research into this to make sure that everything is completely accurate. But those were the years that we organized. In June of 82, we had our election, and I believe we were certified around June 19th of that year. Now, the interesting thing is I could not vote in the election because the job title I had at the time was assistant head nurse, which was very similar to a charge nurse position. And so it was determined that my job was a management position. So after the election, I took a job in the operating room so I could get back into the bargaining unit. And then became in November, after all that was done, I was elected president of the local.
And so you had your own local, that was just the workers there in the hospital. It wasn't part of 1122 or.
Right. We
Okay.
became Local 1168, and I think that's one of the most wonderful things about the work that the local did with us because they knew from the very beginning that we wanted to be our own local. We really wanted to, work on behalf of our own interests and be our own organization. And that was an issue from day one. So every hour, every penny, all of the energy that they put into our campaign was not because they thought they were going to have 750 new members. It was because they really believed in us and wanted to support us through the campaign. And then, we established our own local.
How wonderful is that, right?
Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, so you've done this monumental task. You've organized this group of nurses. You get yourself elected as their local president. Well, you take a downgrade from manager, quasi-management position, to go into the bargaining unit. You're elected local president. Now you've got to get a contract. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
So in the months between June and November, the folks in the bargaining unit really went about all of the tasks that you have to do to establish a local. So they wrote bylaws, they found an office, they elected a bargaining committee, prepared for negotiations, and they were actually at the bargaining table in November when I was elected. And it's really funny because even when I was still in management, after they started to put the bylaws together, they came to me and said, "Debbie, we think you should be local president." And I said, "Okay, if that's what you want me to do, that's what I'll do. I'm trying to get into the operating room, so as soon as that works out, I'll let you know and we can hold an election." So I went then from being elected right to the bargaining table because negotiations had already begun. And it was clear from the very beginning that we were in trouble in bargaining. The hospital hired a union busting attorney from Rochester, Carl Kraus, his name was, and very typical anti-union actions. So limited time at the bargaining table, unwillingness to reach tentative agreements, every article that we talked about, there was something that they knew we just couldn't agree to. We were going to get a contract, a first contract. It was important to us to get a good first contract. So we bargained through the end of 82 and into 83, and we continued to organize inside the bargaining unit. And the worse we were treated at the bargaining table and reported what was happening to our members, the stronger and more committed to one another they became. And we thought by March that we might have to go on strike because they just were not moving to a contract. And I remember being very nervous about this membership meeting where we had to talk to the members about the possibility of striking. And when we gave them the bargaining update, like people in the room were just saying, "We should go on strike. We should go on strike." And so, we didn't even have to worry about bringing the topic up because everybody was fed up. And as it turned out, we did have to go on strike to get that first contract, May 1st of 1983. And we were on strike for about 80 days. It was around somewhere between July 19th and the 21st. I couldn't remember the exact dates that the strike ended. And boy, I would say that those were. This was, and I, this is a, just another aside. On April 9th, I got married. So, and it was probably the dumbest thing I have ever done. And then shortly afterwards, found out that I was pregnant. So I was doing all of this while I was pregnant. these were probably not at my wedding reception in Long Island, where my ex-husband was from, was leading up to the strike. Like the strike date was set when I was at my wedding reception. And so to me, I feel like it was a low moment in my career because I wasn't there for the last day of bargaining. And by the time I got back to Buffalo, the strike had already started. But that was one of the most difficult periods of my life. I had no idea the responsibility that you felt and the weight, felt like the weight of the world and the responsibility for all those nurses and their families was resting squarely on my shoulders. And the hospital, very early on in the strike, told us that and told the community that any nurse that went on strike would never work at Buffalo General again, that they were going to replace us and the hospital would resume operations. And, the strike would be over. So we really felt as though we were in a struggle for our very existence. And we went from being very timid little Dick Lipsett Sr., who was our lawyer at the time, told us, you went from a bunch of Florence Nightingales into these fighters on the picket line, and it's exactly what happened. We were fighting for our existence, and so we had to use every method, every tool that we could to win that strike and get our jobs back. And I remember on the first day of the strike, I don't know if you remember Don Hoke, but he was a big man. And he came to the picket line at our emergency room entrance. And one of the first cars that went through, he pulled a screwdriver out of his pocket and stuck it in the radiator, and the car died. And the nurses called our office and were like, there's this guy out here, and you better get him out of here. He just, shoved a screwdriver in the radiator. The car's dead. The police are here. So we went running over, and they all thought, the folks from the telephone company all thought it was pretty comical. And the nurses were upset. By the end of the strike, we had a nurse who couldn't stop a car. So she threw herself up on the hood of the car and blocked the windshield. So that's what we went from being scared to being very active on the picket lines.
Quite an evolution.
Really, in a short period of time.
But what an incredible time in your life. You're leading an organizing drive from a management position. So obviously, at some substantial risk of your employment, you organize the union, you transfer out of that job to another job, you become president of the local, you get married, you become pregnant, and you lead a strike all at the same time. I mean, obviously, we were all much younger then, and maybe didn't feel the stress that had to be monumental. Like you said, the responsibility that you feel as a local leader when you're on strike is just like nothing else you've ever felt. So, how did the strike ultimately get resolved? Well, you talk about the contract that you achieved at that point.
So the strike,
Oh,
it
let me ask
many.
one quick question. Buffalo General, is that a privately owned hospital, or was
It
it?
is a private not-for-profit
Okay.
in New York, yes.
Okay.
Like many strikes, it did not get settled at the bargaining table. And, we had no idea how this world worked, but we knew that we were winning because the hospital was only able to hire about 42 permanent replacements.
Wow.
We knew that the volume was not there. At that time, Buffalo General was 110 beds, and they only had about 300 functioning beds that were staffed by management, and we had about 100 scabs, people who just never went out on strike. People did not cross the picket line and go back to work, but we couldn't get movement at the table. And Morty, who was the District 1 vice president at the time, somehow a connection was developed between the Board of Trustees president and Morty. And those were the two that talked and figured out how, things would, or discussed the possibility of how things would end. And that was, we were kind of punks at the time. And so that was infuriating to us because we felt like we brought this far, and now the contract is going to be settled without us. But what Morty did and what we learned is that he went in with our list of the six or seven items that were open when we went on strike and pushed them as far as he could possibly get them. And the biggest issue, the one that I remember, the union issues we were able to resolve, were wages. And I think we were looking for a 10% raise or some very high number. Back then, I was making about $8.63 or something like that an hour. And we ended up with a 2-year contract, I believe, 2-year contract with a 6% and a 6% increase. And then a resolution on the issues that were still open. And really, the culmination, as difficult as it was for us to accept that this was as much as we were going to get, we had to sit down as an executive board and a bargaining committee and decide if what Morty was able to negotiate was something that we were willing to take back to the members. And we deliberated for hours and finally decided that we would take it back and that we would recommend a ratification. And so we had 650 people that were on strike. I think virtually everybody was at the meeting. We had it at the Marigold Manor. It was full. The room was packed. And we went through the terms of the agreement. And then I just remember giving this very impassioned speech about what we had achieved and why this was a good contract. And that now the fight had to move from the streets back into the hospital. We had to take the contract that we had fought so hard for and implement it inside the facility. And, I was physically and mentally and emotionally exhausted. So I started crying. There was a bar there, unfortunately, where some of the folks had been drinking. And when I started crying, one of the guys that were on strike started calling me names and yelling and hooting and hollering from where he was standing. My ex-husband was in the room, and one of the guys that was on the bargaining committee, who I just to this day adore, and they kind of jumped this guy. So there was a huge fight, and oh, what a mess it turned out to be. And the press had followed us for months. We were on the news and on the front page of the paper every day for 80 days, all kinds of articles. We have quite a library of those days and everything that we went through. So there was a reporter in the room, outright outside the room, waiting to come in and do a story once, we were through with our meeting. So it was just a scene like I had never been a part of before. But the contract was ratified wholeheartedly that night, and that's how the strike ended.
What an incredible string of events to get you to that point. What so do,
It really was.
yeah. Do you recall offhand what was on the table when you actually went on strike versus what we accomplished by the end of it?
I don't remember exactly, but I could find out, Jeff. So it, truly, if there's anything more that we would like to add to this and be more detail oriented, I can go over to the local. I'm working with one of the women there to make sure that the history is as clearly documented as possible. So it wouldn't take much for us
Oh, that's
to
wonderful. Yeah. You know
get those items.
what you could do if you're going to send us a picture of yourself for this interview, if maybe you could take a picture of one or two of the headlines from the Buffalo paper and send those along to us as well about the
Absolutely.
strike. I think that would be, kind of a I for some reason we're trying to think of what else we can do with these interviews as we go forward, and having something like that I think could be useful for us going
And
forward.
if you don't mind, I have two pictures of myself. One that I laugh at, which is the picture of me in my uniform giving the commissioner the petitions. But there's one of me marching in front of a rally, a procession of about 1,000 people. We had a church, the priest that was about a block away from the hospital let us use his church and school hall for our meetings and rallies. And then we marched out of the hall and around up Main Street, around the hospital, and circled the hospital. And that is my favorite picture of myself ever, I think.
No,
I
please
don't
share
take
that.
pictures, but maybe I'll give you that picture for
Yeah.
this interview then.
Yeah, please share that. That would be great.
I
I
will.
think it'd be like I said, we don't know exactly what we're going to be doing with these going forward. They're going to be deposited in the labor archives, but beyond that, we'd like to do some things with them. Also, we're going to meet with Beth Allen at CWA to kind of talk about what possibilities we're going to have for some of this. So, okay, now
Jeff,
you've
I
sure.
have a couple. I know I
Yeah.
don't want to slow it down because we've
No,
got
no,
a
no.
lot to cover, but I have a few follow-ups. First of all, your local archives papers are still at the local?
Yes.
Okay, do never throw them out.
No, we won't.
If you have to move, talk to me and we'll figure out a way to get them to the CWA archives at NYU, but do not throw them out.
We definitely will not.
And nobody has written up this story in any kind of narrative, correct?
So one of our secretaries was getting her master's degree And she actually did her thesis on this. And just last week, I discovered that there was a hardbound copy of the work she did in the local. So that does exist.
It's a hardbound, so it would probably be pretty time consuming to scan and PDF it, but I would love to see a copy or to
Okay.
make a copy of it.
We will work on that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A few follow-ups. How many of your 650 strikers were women?
Almost. Over 90%, maybe closer to 95%.
Okay.
This was a real, and the strike was led by women. There was one man on the bargaining committee. There was maybe one other man that worked in the strike office, but this was a real women's campaign.
And would
And
you
I'll
go
go
on?
ahead. No, you go ahead, Debbie.
I think I was asking what you were going to answer. Was a women's consciousness of feminism part of what was unifying and motivating the nurses?
So I remember, back then we were going through all this and the organizing campaign, and Jerry said to me, Debbie, you're a real feminist. And I was like, whoa, I wasn't sure how to take that because back then, if you used the word feminist, you weren't really sure if you were getting a compliment or if somebody was taking a shot, saying something derogatory about you. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, Jerry's probably right. And this is a feminist campaign because our issues were working women's issues. Like we wanted a child care center at the hospital, and we did open general child care, which was an on-site child care facility. We wanted flexible working hours. We did not want the fact that you were pregnant and on a leave of absence to affect your seniority date. We wanted to make sure that women had the leave time they needed to care for, families. And so it really, and while we were on strike, you not only see the best of people, but you see the worst. How should I say this? You see the tragedies that some women live. That's the best way to say it. So we had one woman who would come into the office. And her husband would be leading the way, all red-faced, and she would be kind of cowering behind him, and he would be screaming at us about why his wife couldn't go to work, and it just broke your heart. You just wanted to hug her and say, "Are you okay? And what can we do to help you?" Because if he acted the way he did in public, we were sure that he smacked her around at home. Any marriage, Larry Mancino said this once, and I think it's true. If you do this work, it'll take a good marriage and strain it, and it'll take a bad marriage and ruin it and or end it. And that's what happened to me. I probably should have never gotten married to my husband. By the time we were going through the strike, I wanted him to go back to Long Island and never come back because I felt like he was negatively affecting my ability to do my job. And you saw that. You saw an increase in the amount that people were drinking, and you saw the stresses it put on families. For some families, the loss of income is felt immediately because there's no cushion. When you're making $8 an hour, you're living paycheck to paycheck. And so, go
Were there
ahead.
strike benefits?
There were strike benefits, and anytime anybody talks about CWA and the Defense Fund, now the Member Relief Fund, I tell them they invested $750,000 in Buffalo before we ever paid a penny in dues. And it's what saved us, Debbie. We were out on strike long enough where we could start to collect unemployment. In New York, you had to be on strike for 7 weeks before unemployment benefits kicked in. But people really struggled. And the support from the Defense Fund really was a significant part of helping us keep people on the picket lines and from going back to work.
I have two more follow-ups. One is, what was I going to say? Oh, often one hears that it's difficult for nurses to strike because nurses care about their patients. And as I look at your timeline, not only this strike, but you had a strike against DeGraff Memorial in 1987, and I think other strikes as well. So how do you respond, and how did the nurses feel about that tension?
The way we talked about it back then, and it's going to sound kind of cold, but it's just what it was, is that it's the hospital's responsibility to care for the patients, and they hire us to do it. And we also talked about the fact that if we can't take care of ourselves, then we'll never be able to adequately care for our patients. Like, we have to do what's right for us first, and then we can go back in and in better circumstances care for our patients. And staffing, safe staffing in hospitals is an issue that I have fought for my entire career. It was an issue back then when a normal assignment for me on the evening shift, I worked 3 to 11, was either myself and 10 patients or myself and 14 patients. And the kind of floor that I worked on was a teaching surgical unit, and we had a lot of big chest and belly cases. And it was physically impossible to provide the care that people needed, especially when you had 14 patients. So, the union, CWA, and our political legislative department has worked very, very hard with us in New York to finally in 2021 pass legislation on these clinical staffing committees and a requirement that hospitals meet with their direct caregivers and develop ratios. But that's the way we talked about it, Debbie. The hospitals hired us to do the work, and if they can't treat us the way that we deserve to be treated, then they have to find somebody else to do it. And if we don't stand up for ourselves, nobody else is going to come in and do it for us. We have to take care of ourselves.
Powerful message. Last question at this point. Buffalo was a union town. I think still is a union town. How did that impact both the nurses? Did they come from union families, union areas, and community support as you were organizing it on strike?
Buffalo definitely was a union town back then. The manufacturing was still there. And what, like, we would have these rallies, and the president of the Buffalo AFL-CIO would be there, and all the people from his executive board, from the UAW and the steel workers and the Teamsters, and they were always up on the dais with us, sharing their words of support. I'll never forget the day that the Buffalo Teachers Federation, Phil Remore, was having a educational meeting at Pine Hands Music Hall, and marched his teachers all the way up to the hospital and then surrounded the hospital. I was at the strike office, and again, I got a call and ran over, and there was Phil with all his unionized teachers just marching around the hospital. I mean, the support that we received from organized labor and the community was amazing. Non-union nurses, joined with union nurses from other facilities and held fundraisers for us and beer blasts. And, you know, it was just amazing.
Okay, so you've survived this experience of organizing and getting a first contract, and a successful pregnancy, I take it as well.
I did. I
All
had
right.
in November of that year my oldest daughter,
Very
who
good.
turned 40 last year.
Okay, well, very good. And so where do you go from here? I mean, we all sort of know a little bit about the history. It's not just Buffalo General that is part of Nurses United. Talk a bit, little bit about where you moved on from there.
So after the strike, we really had to learn how to be a local, because we did not function. We functioned as a strike committee, a striking entity for the first however many months of our career. We were either bargaining or on strike. So we just went about learning how to be a local. You know, what our dues income would be, who would be in the office, how many days a week working, how we would represent ourselves, building a representation structure inside the hospital. We had to have a mediator come in and facilitate the rebuilding of the relationship between the nurses and the hospital. And when we went on strike, another unfortunate thing was that they laid off about 1,000 people from the hospital because the you know, the census went from over 1,000 to 300. And so we had to mend fences with our coworkers who had been laid off during the time that we were on strike. So we had this initial period of rebuilding when we went back to work, and it was really difficult. The first day I went back to work in the operating room, they put me in a room with probably one of the toughest surgeons to work with. He hated the whole concept of unionizing to begin with, But then doctors who had been supportive of us turned against us because the strike affected their pocketbook, especially the surgeons. They couldn't work, or they had to go someplace else to work. And that's the room that they put me in my first day back. And, it was meant to terrify me. And in fact, it did. It was a tough day. But, that's kind of what we went through when we went back in. But we knew where everyone was. We knew all of our coworkers who had been on the line with us. We knew, where the scabs were, where the permanent replacements were, so we knew where we had to be careful and where we had allies, but we had a mediator help us rebuild the relationship. And it worked.
Good.
We developed a good work relationship there. And, I would say, separate from the day-to-day stuff, the most exciting thing that happened is between 1985 and 1991, I would say, there was this whole rash of healthcare worker organizing in Buffalo that really led to not just the expansion of our local, but the creation of at least one additional local, which is 1133, which represents workers in the Catholic health system. So the workers, surprisingly, the workers, many of the workers that had been laid off while we were on strike, organized with our local in like a technical clerical service unit. We organized the same bargaining unit at DeGraff Hospital. We organized a professional unit at Planned Parenthood, the nurse practitioners and the providers there. Then we organized at St. Joseph Hospital, and those nurses came into our local. We had an organizing campaign at Our Lady of Victory Hospital, which we lost. And it was one of the few, or only maybe the only loss, organizing loss we experienced during that time frame. And then local 1133 was formed around the organizing at Mercy Hospital of a huge service technical clerical unit and an RN unit. The RNs lost their election the first time and then won it a year later. So I would say that was the major, building that was done at that time in terms of organizing. We became very active. Our local, I'm really proud of the work we did in the local because we had all these wonderful people and everybody had a different area of interest. So, one of my vice presidents at a little bit later, Patty Deviney, was really into politics and legislative work. So she headed that up. We had another nurse who worked in the operating room who was worried about the gases up there and filtering gases and miscarriages that were happening. And so she became our health safety director by virtue of the work she did up there. We had one nurse, his name was Larry Hudak, who was a brilliant writer, and he wrote all of our updates while we were on strike, all of our newsletters. So he took over as an editor of our local newsletter, And I could just go on and on, but we just developed a very strong, multi-pronged local, stayed very close to the people in the community that helped us, and did organizing. So we had another rash of organizing, which I tried to include in the timeline. Around 1997, 1998, Buffalo General merged with a number of other hospitals, merged with the two Millard Fillmore hospitals, the Children's Hospital of Buffalo, and DeGraff. Was an affiliate of Buffalo General at the time. So they affiliated, full asset merger became one employer, one organization. And as part of the merger agreement, we were able to negotiate card check and neutrality. So we literally organized probably another 2,000 workers as a result of that card check and neutrality. So by the time I left the local in 2000, our membership went from 750 RNs in 1982 to about 4,500 members in 2000.
Well, technically,
So
it went from zero.
it technically went from zero
Yeah.
to 4,500 people, yes.
And then how many more are over in 1133?
About 2,200.
Wow.
So they have the nurses from the nurses, they have almost everybody at Mercy Hospital, and then they have the nurses and the technical folks at Kenmore Mercy as well. So
So
we also have a lot of smaller units now. We organized another unit at Planned Parenthood. We organized a small nursing home in Gasport. We organized an ambulatory surgery center. So there are a number of smaller bargaining units there as well.
how does it feel to be the seedling for all of that growth? It's just an amazing record here.
I guess when I look back on my life now, and I've had this conversation with Dennis, so I'm comfortable having it with you. But I told him next year, I'm probably going to retire. And I'll be 68 at the time. And it's just time, for me to go. There are some very young, strong people that I'm working with. And it's really exciting to see them develop in the roles that they're in, and looking forward to really taking these leadership positions in the union. So for the first time in my career, just feeling a little tired, and maybe it is time for younger folks to be doing the work. I remember in 2022, I was doing a big set of negotiations, and I just thought, oh my God, this is really kicking my ass, and maybe I'm not on my A game anymore. And, it's kind of a tough place to be, because I feel like the union, CWA, and especially the local are as much a part of me as my children are. I feel like, I was there from the beginning. I helped birth it. I helped it to grow into the organization it is. And so there's a part of me that is very, very, very proud. Because I feel like I can go to my grave knowing that I made a difference, that there were people who needed help, that I was able to help. And then there's a part of me that's just very sad because it's what I've done, since I was 22 years old. It's been my entire career moved from nursing, which I loved, into representing healthcare workers and trying to make their lives better while they cared for the patients. And so I don't think it's going to be very easy for me, to walk away from this. I think it's going to be hard.
It's no
But I
su
am proud of the work that we all did.
it's no surprise that you feel like CWA is your family. You ran a simultaneous gestation there with
I did.
it's pretty remarkable. It's like you had twins.
Well, let me tell you this. So when we were on strike at DeGraff in 1987, I was
Yeah, I
pregnant
wanted to get to
with my second daughter,
that.
Caitlin. And then I did have twins in 1990 when we were bargaining a first contract there. And folks laughed at me because I would just lay on the floor with my big old belly on the wood just to take pressure off my back and legs and just kind of holler up from the floor what I was thinking. So you're absolutely right, Jeff. I just raised my family and built the local at the same time. They were things that were going on simultaneously. And eventually, when my twins were two, I did get divorced because my initial instinct was right, which is, my marriage was just a really bad idea. And so, it was myself and my four daughters that were really a unit as we were moving through this. And it's a whole separate conversation, but the effect that it had on my daughters is amazing. And it wasn't just me. It's going to union meetings, being on picket lines, getting to know the other workers and their families, understanding the work I did and the struggle. And the impact that it's had on all their lives is also something that I'm really, really proud of.
Good reason.
I'd just like to have you finish that off. Talk about the impact on your daughters. And for a while, you were a single mom of four daughters and a union president. And I don't know if that time you were still working as a nurse or were totally off the job. That's an amazing. How did you do it all? And tell us a little more about the impact on your daughters.
So let's see. I don't even know how to start with this. And I might cry. Because my mother just stepped in and, well, you can't do it by yourself. And so what you can't do, you need help with, and my mother did that for years and years and years. And she never complained, she never hesitated. If I needed help with the kids, she did it. And I've always been a firm believer because of that it takes a village. Even before Hillary Clinton talked about it, I knew it took a village. I would bring a baby to a meeting, and someone on the board would take the baby and feed and burp and holder while I conducted a meeting. There were always toys in our offices. My daughters loved being in the union office. Just like me, they were working with and living with and playing with people of color. So the issue of race was never an issue for my daughters. They were just people and friends and co-workers of mine that they loved. They're all professional women. Two are in unions. One's a journalist. One is a nurse practitioner at Children's Hospital. One is a nurse at Buffalo General. And then one is a teacher. So I taught them the same lesson my father taught me, which is you're going to work hard for everything you get in life. You're all going to school. You're all going to have a degree. And what I learned is you have to be able to take care of yourself. Everybody should have a job where you have wages and benefits, where you can take care of yourself. And anything after that, I always told them is gravy. If you get married, if you have a partner, if you have a second income, that's good, but you don't ever want to struggle or not be able to care for yourself. And so they learned that lesson. They learned everything about unionism. They're all very, very progressive thinkers. They're all kind-hearted to a fault. You know, they will give you their meal if you don't have one. They were all kind of raised the same way that I was. Very four very strong women. Not perfect. Like all five of us, we have our flaws and our weaknesses, but I feel the way they were raised and the environment we lived in. My one daughter, one of the twins, still can't go grocery shopping with me because we used to get up to the cash register and we would have everything on the conveyor belt. And then it would be, do I have enough money? Do I have a check I could write until I get paid in 2 days? Or do I have a credit card with room on it? And she would always be terrified of what would happen if I didn't. And we still laugh about it. But we just took care of each other. And my mother was just there for them. So it was a struggle, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. My marriage was bad. It was abusive, which I don't think I've ever said to anybody before. And I couldn't stay in it. And that's the other thing that they learned. Like, you don't have to stay in a relationship if it's unhealthy for you, if it's abusive. You have to be strong enough to stand up and walk away from it. So there are quite a few lessons they've pulled out of this life that was our family, our union life that was just ever so intertwined, as they were growing up.
I almost paused because I don't want to change direction too much on this, but That's just a remarkable legacy that your mother has left, and now you've left with these four young women.
Oh, yeah. They adored her, and she was a tough love grandma. And you know, she wasn't, she raised them the way she raised us, and they adored her, just adored her. She took good care of them.
Okay, let me dial back for a minute to some union
Okay.
stuff.
Wait,
Talk about
what was your mom's name?
Joan Hurdle Bonney.
how did you get card check? Talk about that experience. I mean, that's, that's you sort of just toss that out like, oh, well, we got card check. There's got to be more to that story than just a quick aside.
The person that I have to give credit for that, Jeff, is Larry Cohen. Because Larry, you know, and I don't remember the CWA history when it was first negotiated and what bargaining units came in under card check. But I remember talking to Larry quite a bit about it. And, you know, Larry told me, he said, Debbie, two sentences on card check is worth more than a page on neutrality. And he said, while neutrality is good, and, you know, you want them to try and remain neutral in an organizing campaign, card check is the real deal. That's where you got to get. And so when we were doing this merger agreement, we had these two big hospitals that were non-union. The Children's Hospital was organized by SEIU. After that old hospital and nursing home council fell apart, SEIU stepped in and took over there. And there were two big non-union adult hospitals. And we were talking about, well, what if we consolidate work? And if we move work from Buffalo General to Millard? And we kept arguing, we don't want to be union, go from a union to a non-union facility. We want to maintain our union status. And the hospital's position was, you can't, you know, be a lone union member in a hospital where there's no union. And so this is the short version of the story, but we negotiated card check and neutrality, and that was the compromise. If you want to be able to move work, if you want to be able to consolidate services, if you know, want to realize all the advantages of merging these facilities, then we need to know that our union status will be protected as we move through the, you know, various mergers. And so they did do a lot of consolidation, and this card check and neutrality language saved us. We signed the merger agreement in 98. By 99, we were at the bargaining table for the RNs at Millard Fillmore Gates Circle Hospital and bargained their first contract. And by the time we were bargaining for them, they were organizing at the Suburban Hospital. So, you know, when they started moving work around, it was fairly easy to deal with. The hardest, we also had to, over those years, develop a very good work relationship with 1199 SEIU, because there were also some consolidations of work that got done between the children's hospital and the adult hospital, mostly women's services. And so we still have a very good work relationship there. But that is how we ended up with CardCheck, by and large, what we learned from Larry.
So what was the point of leverage, though, that made the hospitals feel like they had to give that to us in order, was there, to move forward, I guess?
So there were two things, I think. The first is that in 1980, I don't remember when, sometime in the mid-80s, the staff that allowed the strike to happen, the administrative staff was let go and they brought new leadership in. And Buffalo General hired a guy named John Friedlander as the president and CEO. And it was just Buffalo General at the time. And when he came in, he asked for a meeting with me and he said, look, we could continue this fight, or we can work together to fix Buffalo General, to fix the damage that was done because of the strike and because of the changes in the healthcare industry and the leadership that was in place. And he said, my preference is to work with you because I have visions of what Buffalo General can become. But it's going to take all of us to get it there. And we, John and I, developed a great work relationship. It got off to a little bit of a bumpy start, but over the years, we developed a great work relationship. And I said to him, look, John, if you want to consolidate services, if you want to be able to turn this group of individual hospitals into a system and get all the advantages of a system, you're going to need to give too. And this is what we're looking for. And I think what they really discovered is that it would almost be easier for everyone to be union because at least there would be one set of rules that would govern everybody at all the facilities. And in fact, not only did we get neutrality and card check, but they agreed to sit down with us in 2000 and bargain a master agreement. So we bargained a contract for all the workers that we represented, SEIU represented, and the operating engineers at the time were a part of our coalition as well. So we essentially sat down and bargained for about 8,000 workers. Under one collective bargaining agreement. So, it was, and as much as I was a rabble-rouser, yeller, screamer, swearer in the early days of doing this, part of what I learned is that if you can't have a conversation with someone, if you're not able to talk through and work through the issues, you're not going to get the job done on behalf of your members. You have to be able to talk to one another. And that was the relationship, that we developed. And for some number of years, the relationship that we had with the hospital. And I think that that led to, our ability to negotiate the neutrality and card check and a common expiration date, common bargaining table. So I can't think of anything more than that in terms of leverage. I think that's really what got it done.
Wonderful. So you're president of 1168 for how long before you joined the staff?
For 18 years.
Okay. Wow.
Long
And
time.
then you joined the CWA staff, and what sort of assignments did you have there?
Well, at first they did not want me to have my old local, so I was assigned some like Buffalo Sewer Authority 1122, where I had some Verizon. 1133, where I did have the healthcare workers. And then it was determined that it didn't make sense for me to be doing work outside of the industry when I knew healthcare as well as I did. And so they gave me an assignment that was all healthcare workers in upstate New York. And I had the VNA 1168, 1133, and then I had Arnett Ogden Hospital in Elmira and St. Luke's Hospital in Utica. So, during those years, I was convinced they were trying to kill me because, like my nursing job, it was a huge assignment and I was traveling and I just wanted to be able to do it right. And as more staff came on, they split that assignment up a little bit. But basically, from 1986 on, I became a full-time union representative, either as a local president or as a staff representative. It's a hard transition. I don't know if people realize how hard it is to go from a local where you really feel like you are completely tied in to this group of people, to a position where you're pretty much functioning, on your own. And it's not like I didn't have coworkers, because I did, but when it came to my assignment, it was me and the locals. So that was a little bit of a tough transition. And at the time I came on staff, Jerry was the area director in the Buffalo area office. And Dave Palmer was the other staff representative that was there. So, like Jerry, I developed a very, very close personal and work relationship with Dave that really spanned all those years. And I think. And I don't know if you know that Dave passed away last
Yes,
year. Did you know?
I did. I know Dave. A wonderful guy.
We were just all heartbroken.
He quite a struggle at the end.
It was
Family.
just really hard. But anyways, Dave and I were buddies and co-workers from the time he started servicing our local as the staff representative while I was president, through last year. He's a good man.
He was working for Erie County by the end, wasn't he?
So this is the sad part with Dave. He worked for Erie County for about 10 years, I want to say, and retired maybe in 21 or 22, and then immediately started with his health problems. So it was really sad to see him in his retirement years kind of struggle the way that he did.
Okay, I don't want to digress too far, but
Yep.
right now you're the area director. What all does that encompass? What is your area of responsibility now?
So right now I have upstate New York, except for Verizon, and then I have Connecticut and New England. And the locals have really kind of consolidated so that there's one big local in Connecticut, one big local in New England, and then I just have from Albany up. There's a separate area director that does all of Verizon. So all of that work is together. And I, by and large, in upstate New York, am doing healthcare.
Well, this 2 hours has flown by. Debbie G, do you have anything else you want to ask?
I have some short and a little bit larger.
Yeah.
Hannah, do we have 10 minutes or so to go on?
Good.
Okay.
Okay.
First, since I don't know you, but I know your name is Debbie Hayes, where does the Hayes come from?
That is my ex-husband's name.
Okay, so.
My maiden name was a problem for people to say and spell, and so I just kept Hayes after I got divorced because it was easy and it was also my children's name. So I just kept it.
What was your birth name?
It was Bonnie, Banyi.
Okay. That's a Hungarian name, I guess.
Hungarian name, yes.
Okay, so you're not related to Jerry Hayes.
I am not related, which I have to say, when we were first working together, especially during the strike, was the question of the day. Are you related to Jerry? And tell him, no, we're not related at all.
What influence impact did you and your locals have on both the rest of CWA in terms of healthcare representation and organizing, and then in terms of lobbying and political activism around healthcare reform?
We encouraged and still encourage other CWA locals to organize healthcare workers because it can be done by locals that are in industries other than healthcare, and we were the prime example of that. But I'll be honest with you, Debbie, I don't know how much healthcare organizing was done because of the work that we do. I know there are other healthcare workers in the national union, but we don't have a council or the kind of work relationship that we do in District One. So our healthcare workers in New York and New Jersey are more connected with one another than we are with healthcare workers in other parts of the country. We were always huge proponents for a national health plan or in New York, a state health plan. When you work in the industry, I think it's more clear than ever the amount of dollars that are not spent at the bedside that should be spent at the bedside and are spent in back offices paying administrators and doing administrative work in insurance companies that just don't need to be spent. So we have always been firm advocates for a national health plan or a state health plan. Politically and legislatively in New York State, we Had worked around no mandatory overtime for nurses, certain specific ratios in ICUs, transplant centers, burn units. But truly, our biggest victory was in 2021 and the law that was passed in New York on clinical staffing committees. And that is a lot of the work I'm doing right now. Since then, we've had to work to get these clinical staffing committees established in all of our New York State locals that have healthcare workers in acute care facilities, teach them, what the law says and their roles and responsibilities, on the clinical staffing committee. And then, go in and bargain what ratios we believe there should be when you're caring, providing direct patient care, whether it's at a bedside or in a procedure lab or in a clinic associated with the hospital. So I would say that that is, we've had small legislative victories along the way, but 2021 was definitely the biggest.
And one hears now about the pressures from the insurance companies and the private equity ownership of so many healthcare facilities, the squeeze that this is putting on providers, meaning nurses, doctors, etc. Do you think the fact that you have a geographic-wide almost unionization in Buffalo and this legislation you've gotten has serve to make a difference, at least in your area, so that nurses and healthcare providers can actually deliver good care?
I believe that we've taken significant steps in the right direction, but like we didn't cover COVID at all. That could be a separate 2-hour conversation on COVID and the effect that it had on healthcare workers in the facilities and then on the industry as a whole. So there were When it first came into the facilities, people were terrified because all we knew was that if you got it, you were probably going to die. And they were not clear on the mode of transmission and what they needed to do to protect the workers. And workers could not get the personal protective equipment that we believe they needed in the facilities. And so people left. People retired. People went into other jobs. And there is right now a severe healthcare worker shortage, not just in Western New York, but in all of New York and across the country. And so while we were able at both Mercy Catholic Health System and Kaleida Health System implement the law, and while the law was being implemented, negotiate some incredible ratios, we haven't been able to recruit and retain people the way we should be able to actually meet the ratios. So, our workers have experienced some improvements in some areas, but definitely not what we need to see. So, again, when I was working on a med-surg floor, we could have anywhere from 10 to 14 patients. Now, on med-surg floors, we believe the ratio to provide good care should be one nurse for every four patients. And, back in my day, you would have gallbladders and hernias and things, procedures done that that are now done on outpatient basis, and these folks never see the inside of a hospital. So the people who do get admitted are much sicker and require much more hands-on care. It's a different population than it was when I was practicing. So it's a really complex picture right now. The state of New York, neither the state or New York, the federal government is better, but they do not reimburse facilities dollar per dollar for the cost of the care that they provide. So the economies are always a struggle. And many hospitals in New York State are functioning with 30 or less days cash on hand. So we're really worried about, making payroll and getting supplies and having the staff that we need to do the work. It's a pretty desperate situation right now.
We could have a whole 2 hours on that, and I'm sure you have many insights to share. I'm not going to go there. I have one last question, and then I know Jeff will want to wrap it up, and maybe Hannah has some questions. When you were local president, I assume you had people of many different races and backgrounds in your local, as well as people who were LGBT. Q plus. How did you, as a local, did you have equity committees? How did you promote equity both within the union and issues that of representation?
Boy, I don't know. So you're right. We had different races, ethnicities, and LGBTQ issues. I don't know if we had a committee until the national implemented that all locals should have these committees. I'm a little embarrassed to say that, but we were always very, very inclusive. We always made it clear in steward and other training that, we do not discriminate against folks based on their skin color, their ethnicity, their gender preference, whether they're gay or straight, or and so it was just a philosophy that we function under. I remember the first person, and we were doing this back in the 80s, so some of this discussion was not as open and out there, and people weren't as accepting as they are, or hopefully are now. But one of the guys that organized the Second Buffalo General Unit in 1985 was a gay man. And, I'll never forget the conversation that we had when he came out to me, and I kind of knew before he told me, so it wasn't a huge surprise when he told me that he was gay, but it was just this feeling of closeness and connectedness that he felt like I was someone that he could tell, and that he felt like it was important for me to know that he was gay before he started telling other people. And, it just, I don't know, it was just always a part of who we were because of Michael, who we were and what we did. And I don't know. I just don't remember there ever being any issue, any discriminatory problems. And again, with my daughters, they, Mike and Andy would come over and help us put up our Christmas lights. So to my daughters, it was just always Mike and Andy. It's just from the time they were little who they knew, Mike and Andy. You know, so I just don't ever remember having specific committees or having to deal with specific problems.
Anna, do you have anything you want to ask?
Sure. Debbie, I apologize if I missed this, but how old were you the year that you got married, got pregnant, and went on strike?
I was 26.
Wow. So you talked about that time as being a time of real struggle, and I'm wondering, it seems almost like a coming of age, both for you and for the workers. Like, what were the biggest lessons that you learned in that period of time?
I think the biggest lesson I learned during that time, Hannah, was that you don't know how strong you are until you need to tap into that strength. So most people who know me say, "Oh, Debbie, she is so nice and she's quiet and she's, you know, not the type of person that we would imagine standing up there in front of a group of 1,000 people, you know, with fist in the air talking about, you know, the fight we were in." And when we went on strike, none of us knew what to expect. But what we learned is that we were all stronger than we thought we were, and that together, pooling that strength together, we couldn't be, you know, we couldn't be beat. And I think the way that you said it was really very eloquent, because I think you're right. It was like a coming of age. There were so many of us that were young, were fresh from either college or nursing school. We didn't know a lot at those tender ages. We had some life experience, but, you know, not a lot. And we were just all kind of forging ahead together. And again, you know, the lessons we learned about, I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, just kind of about humanity and what people's struggles really are like, and the kind of support that people really did need, and what our work really would be, you know, just kind of grew and off we went.
Thank you. I'm wondering if there's maybe a moment or a story you have from that time where you kind of had to find that strength. Is there anything that you can think of? Like maybe one specific moment in time?
So this is one of the darker moments, and it was right after the strike ended. And my ex-husband was a real problem during the strike. And like I said, it was a very abusive relationship. And I was supposed to go to the union office after I got out of work, and we only had one car. And he wouldn't let me drive the car to work, or and he so he picked me up, and then I said I have to go to the union office, and he wouldn't let me go. And he said, "You worked all day, you're coming home." I said, "I have to go to the office. I have people waiting for me." And I just thought it was two people waiting for me. So we went home and we had this terrible exchange. And at one point he said, go ahead, take the car and go. But I couldn't because I was crying and I was a mess and was already an hour too late. And I figured people would go home. So a little later, my doorbell rang and I went downstairs and there was a note from the executive board. And this woman that I was supposed to meet with one-on-one had called a board meeting, which I didn't know about. And they waited for me and I didn't come. And so they sent me this letter about, now that the strike is over, you're not going to fall down on the job. You better step up. And there was one person who didn't sign it, was this guy that was on the bargaining committee, Mike Sullivan. And none of the rest of them watched what I went through during the strike and could put two and two together. But Mike did. He knew what I was what I was going through at home, and he wouldn't sign his name. And he was pretty disgusted with the rest of the crew for sending the letter they did. But talk about an awakening, like an eye-opening moment. It was one of the most awful moments during that stretch, but boy, did it get my attention. And it absolutely made me realize that I was going to be in a struggle, and it was going to be a struggle to do the job I was elected to do. And work in the hospital at that time, and then deal with this, man that I was married to. And I, from that day on, it never put myself in a position where he was going to tell me what I could or couldn't do related to work. But it was. There were many high moments, but that was one of the low ones.
Did you and Mike Sullivan continue to have a good relationship after that?
We did. And I saw him again last year for the first time in many years. And like I said, I just love him to death. He always called me Prez. And he still calls me Prez when we communicate on Facebook. He always says, hey, Prez. And, that's the relationship that we have. And if you see, he worked in the community mental health building and he looked like a biker. He didn't look like a nurse. He had long, scraggly hair and a scraggly beard. And he dressed in black and wore black boots and had a big chain on his wallet. And that was just Mike. And I'll never forget him for the work that he did and the relationship he built, but I'll never forget him for that moment.
Is he the guy that addressed the heckler as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did. He did. He
Okay.
always had my back.
Sounds like it. Well,
Thank you for sharing all that.
like I said, this 2 hours has just blown by. We asked you for 2 hours. You've given us more. I got a feeling we just scratched the surface with a number of topics. I'd love to have a conversation about dealing with COVID in the hospitals and what that must have been like. But thanks again for agreeing to do this with us. It's just been a real pleasure. I can't thank you enough.
Well, like I said, as we started, I am really honored that you thought to include me in this project, and I can't wait to read the transcript. And if there is any time where you feel like you need additional information, or there's any of these other topics that either myself or other people in the local can help with, do not hesitate to reach out, because I just feel like, especially with our younger members, it's so important for them to understand the history and the struggle that went into getting the wages and benefits that we all earn and deserve now. And these projects that you're doing are just so important. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you've encapsulated our motivation with this. I mean, that's really what we're trying to do here, is just capture that history so that it doesn't get lost for the ages. So thanks for being a part of that, and thanks for being such a great contributor to our union. I just am so I feel so fortunate to know you, and to have had this opportunity to spend these couple of hours. Like I said, you're at the outset, you're a legend within CWA, whether you know that or not. Everybody knows who Debbie Hayes is and what she's done up in Buffalo, New York. So
Well,
thanks for
thank you.
expanding on that.
Thank you very much, folks. And like I said, don't hesitate. If there's anything else I can do or we can do from up here, don't hesitate to reach out.